Whereas the Napoleonic Quarterly podcast project takes the epic conflicts of the 1792 to 1815 period 3 months at a time, this podcast miniseries, titled The Napoleon Movie Quarter Hourly, takes the spectacle-filled Hollywood blockbuster Napoleon, directed by Sir Ridley Scott, 15 minutes at a time. It's an unusual concept and one partly prompted by tedious reasons for me not having been able to see the film at the cinema, but there is a legit reason for the approach being taken, which is that I think we in the Napoleonic community ought to do more to understand the logic, maybe some of the decision-making behind the approaches taken in this puzzling, odd, confusingly disappointing movie. That's why I'm delighted to be joined for this little side project by an actual screenwriter, James Topham. He certainly knows a thing or two about screenwriting. Hello, James.
Hello, Alex. It's lovely to be here once again.
Here we are. James, would you say you're an apologist for Ridley Scott?
Look, Alex, Ridley Scott is a great man. He's a man very close to my own heart. But no, I'm here to be a screenwriting bellwether that allows you to understand and fully come to terms with what Napoleon the movie is as a work of art.
A work of art. Right. Okay. That's a bad start. I think the listeners will be shaking their heads at that. But let's see how we get on. Okay. So we've done the first 15 minutes very quickly. There was a lot of blood, wasn't there? Some specific issues relating to mothers and some odd acting from Joaquin Phoenix playing Napoleon. Now in this episode, we're going to talk about the second 15 minutes. And James, I'm going to hand over to you to talk me through it. But just before we get started and work our way through it, one thing occurred to me, which is, of course, the three-act structure. Everyone knows that's the thing in films, don't they? But I don't necessarily know what this first act might look like, or what signals we should be looking for as we try to understand how that first act operates. Could you say a little bit about that?
So the three-act structure, Alex, could not be more important to the art and craft of screenwriting. And the first act of those three is often where we're seeing the world set up, your central character being established, and a problem being set out. So I think what would be really interesting for us as we go through the next 15 minutes, which probably is the core of the first act of the Napoleon, open brackets 2023, close brackets. What is the problem being set out? What is the problem that Napoleon has to solve? So if you remember, Alex, at the end of the last episode, we left Napoleon in triumph at the port of Toulon. He'd captured the big guns that were facing the English's own ships, and he'd successfully fired those big guns into the ship. And when we rejoined,
upon which the ship promptly blew up.
Yeah, well, that, and Alex, as you'll know, that was because of the heated shot that was in those big guns.
Is this a sexual metaphor, by the way?
Well, it's certainly something that we'll have to discuss as we go through the rest of the film, because I feel like sexual metaphors may be abounding in the next 15 minutes.
Oh, no. Okay. Gulp.
So Napoleon's promoted to captain. I don't know what to, something like, you know, lieutenant brigadier or something like that. I'm sure your listeners would know.
It's brigadier general, but it doesn't matter.
He then does something which arguably his soldiers and fellow generals would be astonished by. He goes over to his horse that was killed in the battle. You'll remember quite vividly, Alex. Pushes his fist into the horse's chest and plucks out a cannonball, the cannonball that did for the horse so dramatically in that first 15 minutes. And then what does he do, Alex?
He tosses it to his brother, Lucien Bonaparte, and he says to Lucien something along the lines of, "Take that home to mother."
To give it to mother. And Lucien looks at him like, "Fucking hell, what?" And you can only imagine what Mrs. Napoleon's going to feel when that comes in the post.
She'll stick it on the mantelpiece.
along with kind of five other kind of slightly increasingly sized cannonballs from his previous adventures.
If he does that for every battle that he fights, then there is going to be a mantelpiece problem in the Madame Mayor household, that's for sure.
But of course, it does. We are hitting upon an important theme that was established in the first 15 minutes, which is Napoleon's developing mother complex. I don't know if you've got any thoughts about that, Alex.
Presumably, a mother complex is a real obsession with one's mother to the detriment of one's general health.
Yeah, you're talking as though, as well as not having seen the film Napoleon, you've never had any interaction with the world at all. But yeah, that's definitely how I would describe a mother complex.
It's because I've spent all my time looking at Napoleon stuff and making Napoleon podcasts.
Yes, well, there's a lot of catching up to do, I guess. So yes, it's a motif. Napoleon's developing mother complex. I'm sure we'll come back to that in future episodes. But Napoleon's got stuff to do. He's back in Paris with Barras. They're having a conversation about how bad the terror is. Barras very impassioned about how things are going, and Napoleon, for reasons not entirely elucidated by the script, falls asleep during that conversation.
Why is he asleep? Is it because he hasn't caught up after fighting overnight in Toulon?
He did stay up very late fighting in Toulon.
He had a late night.
Now, one would imagine that there would have been some time required for him to travel back from Toulon. But maybe, you know, maybe it was a difficult carriage ride. He didn't get the rest that he needed. Do you think possibly that Ridley Scott is here trying to say something about Napoleon's character?
That maybe he's... I'm pretty baffled, to be completely honest. Is it something to do with the fact that as a military man he doesn't care for all this political nonsense? Maybe, could that be it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
He seems a man uninterested in listening to authority figures. That might be something that comes up later on in the film. But we cut to the end of the Reign of Terror. Robespierre is in the assembly and the revolution is turning against him. There's a little bit of running around in the assembly. Robespierre decides, to end it all. He's going to shoot himself. But all he does is manage to wound himself dangerously, but he survives. And then for the second time in approximately 2 minutes of screen time, we have a shot of someone sticking their finger into a bloody wound.
Oh no, this is Barras, isn't it? And he's enjoying sticking his finger into the wound, literally, I suppose. Well, if he had salt on his finger, then it would be obvious what he'd be doing.
Quite. Now, do you think, Alex, this is a point you made earlier, do you think this could be a sex metaphor?
I think we need to be conscious of what could be going on in the minds of the filmmakers here. And it did occur to me that there's just a lot of bodily situations happening here, aren't there? It's all very, very unpleasant.
Yeah, and sometimes filmmakers don't know that they are, you know, that those bodily situations, that sometimes, I suppose what I'm saying is there are themes in filmmakers' minds that they're not fully conscious of themselves.
One really funny thing that happened, and I think this is really brought out by the sound. You see, so my approach here is to watch it in 15 one-minute chunks, which is frustrating, and then listen to it all the way through. And the sound of the sound effect as Robespierre shoots himself through the face is really, that is quite good. It's something like... it's good. I imagine they did it by getting a bowl of Weetabix or something and then sort of sticking a spoon into it and it goes...
Well, yeah, no, I'm sure that's exactly how they did it, Alex.
That's filmmaking.
But why do we care about all this? Why do we care about the terror ending and Robespierre running around and people sticking fingers in his face? The answer is that the Bastille is about to be emptied. And this is very significant because it leads to the introduction of someone who I think is going to be an important character in the rest of the film.
A robed figure, initially.
A robed figure, yes. Someone who we cannot be sure of their identity, even their gender.
Although it's obviously Josephine, isn't it?
It very quickly turns out to be Josephine. Almost immediately revealed to be Josephine. And look, Josephine is obviously an important character in Napoleon's life, important character in the film, I suspect. What do we know historically about Josephine, Alex? Is it worth having a history check?
Okay, yeah, just to say, as I made clear in the first episode of this little project, I'm only going to be really drawing on the story of Napoleon, a Ladybird children's adventure from history book published in 1968. It doesn't really mention Josephine, to be honest. I guess it's aimed at children, and given what we're about to discuss, that's probably for the best. So I'm going to have to actually rely on my own knowledge, which is basically that, yeah, she was in tricky circumstances, her husband having been executed, of course, and she was significantly older than Napoleon Bonaparte, but not so old that her various charms were unalluring.
And as we see very quickly, I think it's a classic Hollywood trope that Vanessa Kirby, who's playing Josephine, is, I'd probably say, about 10, possibly 15 years younger than Joaquin Phoenix.
But does that matter, James? Because ultimately, and this is where I wanted to ask about the screenwriting bits of this. Maybe we're jumping ahead, but don't they do? They deal with that in the dialogue, don't they? They get the point across that she's had a checkered past, and then they can move on. And so they've ticked the box. It doesn't matter that in fact she was older, because maybe that's okay. They've explained that she's got a checkered past, and that just happens to have been compressed into
possibly 6 months. Six months of difficult Bastille living. Yeah, no.
Right.
Well, look, we are jumping ahead, because first we've got to contend with Napoleon meeting Josephine at the ball. There's some kind of classic fun, kind of restorationary drama stuff going on. And then Napoleon stares blankly at Josephine across the ballroom, and she kind of comes over and says, what are you staring at? What follows, I think, is possibly the most awkward introductory conversation between two characters that you've ever heard in your life. It feels weird, doesn't it?
Well, to me, it felt less weird because it was in keeping with the previous weirdness we've seen from Napoleon Bonaparte, as portrayed by Joaquin Phoenix. To me, to be honest, it felt like, yeah, I could cope with his odd behaviour, because at least there was a through line from how he was with Barat initially, and how he was whilst fighting the French. Oh dear.
So you think you feel like a character's forming. And how would you describe that character, Alex?
Awkward, wooden, stiff, uncomfortable. Well,
And as we know, I think Napoleon probably had many of those characteristics, historically speaking.
And a little bit greasy.
Really? You'd go as far as greasy?
He was very greasy. I don't think they had Head and Shoulders in the 1790s.
But was he notably more greasy than other people at the time?
Well, you've got to
judge people by the time, haven't you, Alex? You know what I mean?
Well, moral relativism is one thing. But hair greasiness relativism is quite another. And I think if you look at the portraits from the 1790s, he's very greasy. He needs to wash his hair more. He's scruffy.
Yeah, and it even gets into the portraits, which is really, really telling. But what's quite important about this first meeting, I think, is that he asks Josephine not to tell him her name.
Yeah.
Almost as if to say, I think, you know, you're quite fit. If I knew your name, that may be the end of it. I may fall for you.
It's not a direct approach of the kind that would win him later military success. Far from it. If anything, he's not engaging the enemy at all. He's just marching his troops up to the top of the hill and back down again.
Would you say, Alex, that he is covering his ears to the cannon shot of his own desires?
I think he is on the field of battle once again, and he seems as bewildered now as he was on that fort in Toulon.
Well, anyway, the ball ends inconsequentially, and sometime later, a young boy comes to Napoleon in his office, I guess, in Paris somewhere, and the boy asks him whether he will give him his father's sword.
About a little sword, Governor? I've got a charmingly dear father, and I'd love a little memento from him, please. How about that, then?
Please, sir. Please, can I have that sword in the butcher's window? The one as big as me? He, yes, the boy asked for the sword. Napoleon's a bit like, well, I can't give you a sword because I don't want to be seen to be arming the citizenry in Paris. But the boy says, you know, my dad's dead and my mum would really like it. And so Napoleon, you know, being the wet soul that he is, decides to try and find his father's sword.
He's a faceless bureaucrat.
Interesting. What do you mean by that?
Well, this was a real opportunity for Joaquin Phoenix to play around with the character of Napoleon Bonaparte as he was then in the mid-1790s. And I don't know, I quite enjoyed what he did. There was a little bit of, not playfulness, let's not get carried away, but he was at least allowing himself to be amused in the way that someone with very little soul might be amused by something moderately irregular.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think equally importantly, he goes to try and find the boy's sword, which is something that he wouldn't need to do in that situation. Of course, his search for the boy's sword is very quickly curtailed because he arrives in a big room of swords and he asks, you know, do any of these swords have the names of the people who own them on? And someone says no.
But it doesn't put him off.
No.
He changes his strategy. He changes approach based on the information given to him.
He grabs any old sword, basically, and then charges back through the streets of Paris to the little boy's house. Little boy didn't give him his address, but we can assume that, you know, he kind of looked it up in the yellow pages. He arrives at the house, and can you believe it? This boy's mother is someone that he's met before. And so, look, Napoleon has proven himself a kind of a worthy suitor. He's turned out with the dad's sword. And it looks like that Josephine has designs on Napoleon from a romantic perspective. You know, she asks her maid-in-waiting, do I look like him in love?
Yeah, that's after their first date, isn't it?
Do you think?
To be honest, I don't know. Given that I haven't written anything down and you have, we should probably go with your version of it. But that's okay.
Well, we don't need to. We can probably skip the maid. There's no. I don't think there's any fun in the maid stuff. Shall we just get to the?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, Josephine looks like she has designs on Napoleon from a romantic perspective, and then they go on, you know, what you might call their first date, which I would say probably for me gets the gold medal. Certainly in this 15-minute segment and possibly in the film thus far,
we've got the cafe situation where it seems very sophisticated, doesn't it?
They're having a nice cup of tea.
Yeah, that's nice. And then comes the chair dragging.
Yes, the chair dragging. That's right. So Napoleon sort of says, why don't you come over here? And then he gets hold of her chair and drags it towards him.
Just like he'll be dragging the cannon, metaphorically, in just a few minutes' time.
Oh, interesting. You think it's foreshadowing?
Yeah. Well, no, I didn't think that because I'm a bit confused about what foreshadowing is. But yeah, that's right.
Do you think that Josephine in this instance is a kind of a conquest for Napoleon, like Toulon is a conquest, like his future battles are going to be?
Yeah, I think there probably are. I mean, you've got a situation where there is a clear objective. There is some uncertainty about how to achieve that objective. But ultimately, you've just got to saddle up and get carried away whilst not forgetting to cover your ears if there are any particularly loud moments, and go for it. And, you know, clearly we're in the initial skirmishes stage here, as this military analogy continues, but I think dragging that chair over, it has a certain caveman quality to it, perhaps, but in the circumstances, it's one that does seem to be proving effective.
And Josephine seems charmed by it. You know, she giggles.
James, what do you think the screenwriter would have intended with the insertion of the giggle?
Well, I think there's a real power dynamic going on here at the moment. You know, I think she is surprised by his forwardness, but also interested in his lack of social graces. You know, we've got to remember that this is a woman who's been in the Bastille for approximately 3 to 6 months. You know, she's an aristocrat. She's been thrust out of society.
But it would have felt like a lot longer than 3 to 6 months, maybe even 10 to 15 years, perhaps.
Conceivably to her, yeah. But she's an aristocrat. She's been thrust out of society. And now she finds this this man who's sort of kind of this brute force who is willing to, you know, pull and push her about a bit, and perhaps one that she feels like she could mould.
It's going to be fascinating to see how this develops. And I think I, for one, am intrigued, despite knowing exactly what's about to happen. Or maybe not some of the details. Not some of the specifics of exactly how the, what's the phrase, something gets somethinged on the something.
Well, I think there's particularly one detail that I was not expecting at all. And it comes in the next scene when, obviously, as you said, Napoleon and Josephine have to, if they're going to be husband and wife, they need to batter out some difficulties that Josephine's been through. Do you know, when her husband's died, she's been pregnant, she's had to do a lot of things during the terror that kind of put her honour in question. And she's basically saying to Napoleon, you know, my history is a bit checkered, but will you accept me anyway? He says...
She asks, do you mind about all this? About, well, not whether she's been pregnant, but whether she may have attempted to get pregnant. And he says, no, madame. There was a moment when I was thinking of approaching this whole episode in character as Joaquin Phoenix, when he says, no, madame, the whole way through. But I thought it would be impractical.
It would definitely get in the way of the flow, I think.
No, madame. No, madame.
He doesn't move his lips much when he says no, madame. Well, that's acting. That's an acting choice.
And is there a little bit of looking behind the curtain here of screenwriting? Just jumping back a little bit to the scene where they first meet and she points out that he's wearing a ridiculous costume. It is a ridiculous costume, his army costume, because it forces his neck back so that he's looking a little bit down his nose. And it's like he's walking around with a stock on his neck, and it makes him really unable to do anything in a smooth, tactile manner.
Interesting. So you're suggesting that Joaquin Phoenix's lack of acting ability is something to do with his uniform.
Yeah, it's like that time you put me in a tweed jacket, and it turned me into this middle class buffoon.
You've never taken that tweed jacket off, Alex.
I don't know what you're talking about, but it's extraordinary how all of a sudden, you know, I could go into character because of the clothes, that the costume that I was wearing. And maybe that's what's happened here, that the entire performance is being driven by the fact that he can't move his neck very much.
Well, I'm sure that's the case, Alex. And as always, your insights into the art of acting are, you know, kind of astonishing and extremely welcome to me. No, madame.
No, madame.
No, madame. And then they sort of, I suppose, seal the deal on their relationship. And how would you describe the way that, you know, how would you describe what happens next, Alex?
Well, it's an extraordinary moment in cinema, isn't it? Contrasting greatly with the music that's playing in the background and the sophisticated circumstances in which they find themselves, we see, I suppose, a direct approach. You know, one of the big themes I've noticed, not in terms of thematic content that we're going to be looking at, but as we explore the art of screenwriting and how it essentially involves squidging lots of information down into just one or two sentences or actions in this case, it seems to me that you have an entire process of romancing and seduction being boiled down to potentially a single movement. And throughout cinema, we've seen a lot of explorations of this process of moving from two separate people being united together into a relationship. And here it's just a simple case of moving a couple of limbs and Bob's your uncle, as we say.
Yes, yes. So Josephine opens her legs and sort of motions towards her nether regions. But I think, you know, that if it were just an action, Alex, I think that would be in itself a startling kind of moment in cinema. But combined with the line she then delivers.
You're right.
And I've written it down, as you can imagine.
Let's hear it from you. I'll be Napoleon, you be Josephine.
She says, "Look down and you'll see a surprise. And once you see it, you'll always want it."
Okay, shall I have a go?
Yeah.
"Look down and you'll see a surprise. And once you'll see it, you'll always want it."
Now, obviously, kind of boiled down into that single line, there's a lot of subtext, a lot of emotional import. I don't know, Alex, if you've got any thoughts on the poetry of that line or the language.
Well, it's got a certain rhythm to it, hasn't it? A certain rhythm.
"Look down and you'll see a surprise." I mean, it's iambic pentameter, isn't it?
"Look down and you'll see a surprise. Is it poetic or is it not shockingly base?
Oh, no, I don't think it's base. I mean, she doesn't. I mean, she said it's a surprise.
One approach I was thinking of taking to this would be to say, yeah, this is straightforward, isn't it? Isn't this how every year? It's certainly been my experience, but I couldn't bring myself to do that.
Okay, all right. And how does the scene end, Alex? So she says, "Look down and you'll see a surprise. And once you'll see it, you always want it." And then we have what screenwriters often call a button on the scene, which is a moment, an action, sometimes a word, but often an action that just closes off the scene entirely.
Yeah, the scene, the shot, it cuts to Napoleon Bonaparte. He's looking at her. And then he looks down. Without moving any of the rest of his body. So just in case you happen to be looking at maybe his shoulders or his chin or anything else, it wouldn't matter because your eye would be drawn to the only emotion, which is his eye looking down.
So if you remember in the first episode, Alex, we talked about a character's wants and needs. So Napoleon, what do you think his wants are at this moment in the film? And what do you think his needs are?
Well, I think his wants have focused, really, haven't they? He's been captivated by this individual who's come into his life, and without really doing anything over the top, he's stared at her, he's looked down, he's dragged a chair, done a bit of chair dragging, but on the whole, there's nothing too strenuous, nothing that risks putting his back out.
He carried that sword across Paris.
Well, he did. He carried a sword. Yeah, that's good. But it was a light sword. It wasn't one of those heavy sabers. So, yeah, you know, this is all not too bad a situation for Napoleon Bonaparte. He just wants Josephine, doesn't he? This is straightforward.
I think that's right. And I think now that he's seen her, he'll always want her.
So she claims.
Oh, well, spoilers. But look, before we get into that, things are bad in Paris, and Napoleon is walking around the city streets with, some would argue, his true love, which is of course Mark Bonner, Scottish actor, well known from playing Dougie Henshaw's friend in Shetland.
Clearly obsessed with, yeah.
There's a royalist sort of counter revolution starting to bubble up on the streets, and Barat. He takes Napoleon aside and he says, "Look, I'm a bit scared. I want you to sort this out for me, a bit like you did in Toulon." And Napoleon says, "Yep, no, that's no problem. I'll defend the city for you, Barat. But one condition: I've got to have a free hand. I'm not going to be second in command to you. I'm going to do it how I want to do it." Interesting character moment, I think. Interesting change in character dynamics.
It's a good data point, and it reflects what you said earlier about the potential issues with authority figures.
Yes, that's right. That's right. He wants the whip hand, doesn't he?
He certainly does. Yeah, he certainly does. What do you make of that? I mean, it seemed like an efficient piece of writing to me. We often hear that sometimes in screenwriting, you know, you can just cut to how things have developed in a, I don't know, a few days' time. Ah, here's the result of that conversation. But they seem to do it mid-scene. They could just skip a few lines. How efficient.
Look, so far, it has been an extremely efficient screenplay, almost to a fault, almost to the point where I've got literally no idea when we are, what's happening, who people are. It's bowling along at an incredible pace, Alex.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose that reflects the great pressure of trying to tell such a complicated story in under only 3 hours. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
only 150 minutes.
We're
pretty much at the 30-minute mark, right? We're on the streets of Paris. Napoleon rolls out some cannons on the people of Paris.
And that's it. That's where we pause.
Would say almost on the 30-minute mark, Napoleon puts his hands over his ears in what is becoming, in what we predicted would be a motif last episode.
He's putting his hands over his ears. I'm not sure whether that is exactly with it, but okay, it doesn't matter.
I thought it was bang on 30 minutes.
Okay. Well, in any case, that's a good place to end, isn't it? Because yet again, there are about to be lots of bangs.
Yes, Alex, you're right. There are about to be lots of bangs.
Is that a good place to end?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So if we don't need to say anything else, if you have any questions or comments about the bangs or anything else, please email napoleonicquarterly@gmail.com with the utmost despatch. But for now, I'm going to be off to watch another 15 minutes of this. James, do you want to watch another 15 minutes? Should we keep going?
I'd love that, Alex. I'm on tenterhooks to see what happens next.
James, all that remains is for me to say that if you look down, you'll see a surprise podcast episode. And if you listen to it, you'll always want it to listen to. Goodbye for now.